On April 29, 2012, the Boston Workmen's Circle Center for Jewish Culture and Social Justice celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Bread and Roses strike with a presentation called As We Come Marching. This event was held at the Boston Teachers Union Hall and featured the Yiddish community chorus A Besser Welt, A Better World. Recorded by your radio host Chuck Rosina. Narration was by Holly Newman, and Lisa Gallatin is the artistic director. Dick Monks was the MC, and he introduces the program.
I'm a union guy. I've been a union organizer in Boston for about 40 years, and still standing. And later in the program, we'll be honoring a great friend, but also a true leader among leaders, union organizer here in Boston, but also Washington, D.C., that's Gene Bruskin, and we'll be doing that later. And we have to especially be thankful to the Boston Teachers Unions, their president, Richard Stutman. These are the folks who teach our kids. This is their hall. They gave it to us for free, so we thank them very much. And thank a teacher the next time you see one. 1912 was an amazing year. We've already been celebrating many centennials. Girl Scouts of America, the sinking of the Titanic in the North Atlantic, the opening of Fenway Park, where our baseball team, the Red Sox, play their ball. And we should remember this, fans. They won the World Series in 1912. So hold on to that. But the Lawrence strike of 1912 is not as well known. But we believe the lessons are more important to us than all those other events. Think about it. 25,000 people separated by all the fears and prejudices of the time, race, nationality, language, age, gender, etc., etc. They got through that. They came together, they stood up, they walked off the jobs, they did a brave and bold action, and they won. That's something all of us could leave here today remembering. It can be done. So why is the Workman's Circle doing this program? This was not a Jewish strike. Yes, there were Jewish workers in those sweatshops, but there were folks from all over the world working in Lawrence during those days. Well, the Workman's Circle was founded in 1900 by Jewish immigrants, mostly working in the sweatshops. And right away, they became an ally and helped grow the labor movement of the early 20th century. In fact, the medical aid the Workman's Circle gave to its members and to strikers throughout New England made them become known as the Red Cross of Labor. Today's program was written and produced by A Besser Welt, A Better World, the Workman's Circle Community Chorus. They'll be singing in some of their songs in Yiddish. Yiddish was the language of the Eastern European Jewish community, and it was also the language of the early Jewish labor movement. So get ready. Here we go. The strike of 1912.
They came from 51 different nations, lived in tenements in the most densely populated neighborhood in the country, and were lucky if they could afford the molasses to go with their morning bread. 28,000 men, women, and children worked in 30 mills in the city of Lawrence, some so large they stretched for 44 blocks. By 1912, power looms that had run at 90 picks per minute in 1890 were racing at 140 picks per minute. Lawrence spindles produced more cloth per employee than any other textile town in the U.S. When a new law went into effect, cutting the work week from 56 to 54 hours, the mill owners sped up the lines and production didn't miss a beat. But wages, they were cut. As workers opened their paychecks, years of pent-up anger broke out, and with a cry of short pay, all out, the strike was on.
Short pay, all out.
one of the most dramatic strikes in American history was sparked by a pay cut of 32 cents a week, 3 loaves of bread.
Brothers and sisters, all gather round. Together we are strong enough to shut these mills down.
Shortly before 6 a.m., while the city slumbered, a factory whistle blasted through a blanket of Arctic air across a dark skyline silhouetted by big-shouldered buildings and pierced by smokestacks. Another whistle followed, and another. Each was sharper than usual because that morning was brutally cold, even for Massachusetts in January. And from the mills, the Pacific, the air, the Everett and the Atlantic, the Washington and the Arlington, the small Kunhardt and the awesome wood mill, the whistles screeched. While streetcars rumbled through downtown, tepid bulbs and oil lamps lit up row after row of tenements. Bleary-eyed people, shivering, stamping their feet, muttering their own peculiar curses, shuffled into dingy kitchens. Water taps were turned on but emitted only the dull thud of frozen pipes. Babies cried because they were hungry, and parents knew exactly how they felt. Finding what privacy they could, women squeezed into starched white shirtwaists, while men elbowed for room at mirrors and shaved with straight razors. Then, with the city still dark as midnight, the workers of Lawrence headed for the mills.
Let us
They were as miscellaneous as any populace on earth. 7 out of 8 were foreign-born or children of immigrants. Half had been in America for less than 5 years. In the newly coined metaphor of the time, this melting pot contained the seizings of dozens of different nations. There were Poles from Galicia, Italians from Sicily, Syrians from the Ottoman Empire. There were Jews from Riga, Odessa, and other exotic ports of call. Beside them marched Scots, Armenians, Portuguese, Belgians, Germans, English, French, Canadians, Russians, Greeks, Irish, and many more nationalities. They ranged from tall 12-year-olds whose forged work papers claimed they were 14 to men and women approaching 50. Some were slightly older, but not many lasted that long in the mills. Inhaling fibers that floated through dank, humid mill rooms, a third died within a decade on the job. Malnourished, they succumbed to tuberculosis, pneumonia. They were crushed by machinery, mangled by looms and spinners. Those who avoided accident or disease just wore out like an old suit. Yet on this icy morning in January, defying the odds, 28,000 were marching to work.
So wild is the roar of machines in the sweatshop. I often forget I'm alive in that din. I'm drowned in the tide of the terrible tumult. My ego is slain. I become a machine.
Es räuscht in Fabrik, als ich will die Maschinen. Als oftmals vergesse ich in Räusch, als ich bin. Ich werde in dem schrecklichen Tummel verloren. Mein Ich wird dort bottle. Ich werde a Maschine.
I work and I work without rhyme, without reason. Produce and produce and produce for what end? For what and for whom? I don't know. I don't wonder, since when can a whirling machine comprehend?
Ich arbeite und arbeite und arbeite an Cheshbin. Es tut sich und tut sich und tut sich an Zoll. Für was und für wemen? Ich weiß nicht, ich kenne nicht. Wie kommt der Maschine gar zu denken einmal?
Es Fröschen Fabrik, als soll will die Maschine. Ich arbeite und arbeite, ich arbeite und arbeite. Und oft mal vergess ich in Rösch, als ich bin. Ich weiß nicht, für was, ich weiß nicht, für wen. Und oft werde ich Bord und ich werde a Maschine. Es läuft, es läuft, es läuft die Rede. Es läuft, es läuft, es läuft die Rede. Es läuft, es läuft, es läuft, es läuft.
On that Friday morning in January 1912, the workers flowed together in a torrent of heads, caps, and faces, sweeping past the ornate storefronts of downtown. With the start whistle just minutes away, they picked up pace, powered, it seemed, by rumors. The night before, the rumors had swept through alleys, up stairwells, into cramped tenements. The rumors were ominous, inspiring, amazing. 200 Polish women had stopped work at the Everett Mill on Thursday afternoon. Not enough pay, they said. When they refused to work and were ordered out, they began shouting, urging others to join them. 1,000 looms were shut down. All night, the rumors had flown through the tenements. Now they came into the dawning light, and a single word circulated in dozens of tongues. In Italian. In French. In Russian. In Arabic. In Yiddish. Jewish. In English. The strike began like a spark of electricity, one overseer recalled. Racing into the Washington Mill, men and boys shouted, "Short pay, all out, all out." Hundreds bolted past startled workers. Within minutes, more had left their machines. They stormed through the mill, shouting, whooping, calling to others, pulling knives. A few slashed the belts that rose like giant rubber bands, connecting machines to overhead camshafts. Machines coasted to a stop. Outside, strikers from other mills began gathering at the gates. Just after 10 a.m., police responded to the riot call. By 2 p.m., nearly 11,000 were on strike or locked out as the morning's frenzy spread through the city. That night, an organizer from the Radical Union, Industrial Workers of the World, took the midnight train from New York to Lawrence. In the days that followed, the IWW demonstrated what a difference it would make as the leader of this volatile strike. While the rattled mayor predicted further rebellion would lead to an awful slaughter, IWW organizers, first Joseph Ettore and Arturo Giovannitti, and later Big Bill Haywood and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, urged strikers to be peaceful yet unrelenting. The early violence and venting of rage gave way to a steely determination.
Be proud of your labor. It gives you the right to savor the fruits of the earth.
Sei stolz auf dein Arbeit, sei stolz, sei stolz.
By midweek, Lawrence resembled an urban bivouac, its streets commanded by armed companies who marched every few hours to and from their duty. The whole fortified city seemed to be waiting, watching. Armed with pistols, rifles, and bayonets, the militia encircled the city and protected the mills. Strikers were soaked with fire hoses in the frigid winter air, clubbed and beaten. One young worker was bayoneted to death. But by the end of the week, more than 20,000 were off the job.
Tatis, mamas, kinder, kinder,
tatis, mamas, mothers, kinder, children,
Neuen Barrikaden, building barricades.
Tatters, mothers, kinders, neuen Barrikaden. Tatters, mothers, children, to our building barricades. 20,000 in a room, Arbeiter und Jan. Detachments march along the street, workers on parade. Sisters out of free from Stuma, they go there for me. Father went off to the flight quite early in the day. Werther schon in Stiebelen in Kopenhagen zu lieb. And he won't be coming home, for now he's gone to stay. Kids know well that Daddy will not be home tonight. Sisters has a hunting gas, mits and extra lumen. Daddy's with his rifle there, he's in the street to fight. Sisters are the life of getting gas, but worth an apple. Mother's also in the street with apples she can sell. Staying kids by yourself, daddy, tell her mint and apple. Orphans in the kitchen make the place the pot as well. Sisters have adventures, a con of the diagon. Don't hold your breath for supper, says Hannah to the lads. Bobby Mama is a bed to help him and Bobby. His mom's not coming home, yet she's out there helping Dad. Losing half a bullet is a lining plain with evil. A sudden bang, a bullet has come to pay a call. A ride of toy in Hannah, and they're mocking on the people. It misses right past Hannah, and pops into the wall. We're building just a barricade in the middle of the road. About a car, a shell, and we're hiding hidden now. We'll use an empty barrel and draws from the commode. The product had a life to shell and she will knit a cane. The barricade is up now and no one's left at home. Lurkins call and say goodbye, the kinder bought from Shane. Yeah, the police are running by, the kids are throwing stones.
Amid all the threats of violence, the jubilance of the strike's first parade caught everyone by surprise. The parade grew like gossip. Rallying behind a large American flag, a few dozen set out, cheering and shouting to everyone they passed. Men, women, and children came out, waving, applauding. Many more joined, some carrying their own stars and stripes, as the procession swept through the neighborhoods. By the time it flowed into downtown, the parade numbered 10,000. And through the cacophony, some heard a band strike up the worldwide hymn of workers' revolution, the Internationale. Thousands joined in, as they would again and again in the weeks that followed, each in his or her native language.
Arise, ye prisoners of starvation. Arise, ye wretched of the earth. For slaves, no more enthralled, the earth.
cost of healthcare, gas, and freight. It all works out
for the rich, but not for the 99%.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
You're listening to the Boston Workman's Circle presentation, As We Come Marching, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Bread and Roses strike. During the singing of the Internationale, people spontaneously stood up as a sign of respect to what is their national anthem. What happens next is members of Occupy Boston who were in attendance did a mic check.
Lawrence, where more than half the mill workers were women and children, had always had what the local press derided as women agitators. By mid-February, with men's endurance faltering and a gnawing famine as near as each empty kitchen cupboard, women strode into the front lines of the strike. Throughout the tenements, women met in doorways or on street corners to discuss strategy. They pooled their meager resources, cooking together, caring for each other's children. On sidewalks, they linked arms and swept up the street, singing and calling out to passersby. Women threw pepper in the faces of police and militia, cut their suspenders with scissors, or sent them flying off horses jabbed with hat pins. "One policeman can handle 10 men," lamented Lawrence's district attorney, "while it takes 10 policemen to handle one woman."
Oh, we are women,
we are women,
and we are marching,
we are march.
Bella Chow,
Bella Chow,
Bella Chow, Chow, Chow. We are marching,
we are marching.
As the sun rose over the mills and the rest of Lawrence slept late on a Saturday in mid-February, mothers and their children quietly gathered to give this bitter and vindictive strike a human heart. There was much to do in preparing 150 children to be sent into the care of strangers. Each child had to be registered and pinned with a paper listing name, age, address, and nationality. Parents had to be reassured that their children would be safe, that host families had been carefully screened, that this was all for the best. And above all, if the strike was to be won, tears had to be stifled. The station platform bustled with farewells and embraces. Inside the car, the children rushed for window seats and pressed their faces against the glass. Then, as the train began to pull out, the platform billowed with waving handkerchiefs, and the sadness gave way to a great shout. The children of Lawrence were off to New York City, Philadelphia, and Barrie, Vermont. Out of harm's way and into the care of supportive families. Police were determined to stop the next children's exodus 2 weeks later. The trouble began when police formed a gauntlet between the waiting room and the arriving train. Mothers marched their children toward the train, and to the horror of onlookers, police grabbed the women, tearing them from their boys and girls. Children screamed as their mothers were dragged away.
I saw them grab a little
children and throw them into patrol wagons.
The women fought back, fists flying, fingernails scratching.
One policeman took his billy club and struck a woman, a pregnant woman, right on her belly.
Battered and hysterical, the women were arrested while the children were rounded up. The next day, newspapers across the country reported accounts of the clubbing of women in a Massachusetts mill town. A stunned President Taft ordered his attorney general to investigate. Children were sent to Washington, D.C. for a congressional hearing. After 7 brutal weeks, this assault would prove to be the turning point in the strike that had stirred America's conscience.
This concluded the story of the Bread and Roses strike, but there was still more to the event. Union activist Gene Breskin was honored for his work in the labor struggle, and the children of the Workman's Circle had their own presentation. Here once again is MC Dick Monks.